Hey everybody, welcome to the Brains Bible Institute. I'm Tim Warner, your teacher. We're in the book of Revelation, going verse by verse through that. This is module number 11 in our Brains Bible Institute, and today is going to be lesson number 33. I want to get into the last half of Revelation chapter 13. Now, last week we went over just two verses, verses 9 and 10, which deal with very specific instructions from Jesus regarding those who might be inclined to take up weapons and defend themselves during that last, that last 3.5 years. And so he gave a dire warning there. We covered that last time. But beginning in verse 11 through the end of the chapter, it continues on with what he was talking about in the first part. So what I want to do very briefly is go back and do a real quick review of the first 8 verses of chapter 13. Now, what we learned there was that there's a beast who arises from the sea that John sees as he's standing on the shore of the sea. He sees this beast coming up out of the sea. We saw that it had 7 heads, it had 10 horns, and it had 10 crowns on the 10 horns. And we talked a lot last time about how that beast should be understood based on, especially on Daniel chapter 7, where we have these various beasts coming up sequentially out of the sea, which is the Mediterranean Sea. And they represented the kingdom of Babylon, the kingdom of Persia, the kingdom of Greece, Alexander the Great, and then his, it talks briefly about how his kingdom is divided into 4. And then, of course, the fourth beast, which was dreadful and powerful, which was the Roman Empire. And this beast arising out of the sea at the beginning of Revelation chapter 13 is similar to what we saw portrayed in Revelation chapter 12, which was a beast that's identified as Satan, who has 7 heads and crowns on the 7 heads. And we talked about the meaning of that Satan is portrayed as having 7 heads because he has had 7 kingdoms down through the age from the time of creation. And each time his kingdom has been, as he has sought to overthrow God, God has supernaturally intervened. And so we see these succession of kingdoms. Again, we'll talk about those 7 kingdoms specifically when we get to chapter 17 of Revelation, because it helps us narrow that down better. But my point last time, or the time before last, was that the crowns were 7. There were 7 crowns, and they were on the 7 heads, showing Satan's dominion down through history. Here, this beast coming up out of the sea also has 7 heads, which means it's just another manifestation. It's the final manifestation of those succession of kingdoms. But now it has 10 horns on one of the heads, and the 10 horns have the crowns now, as opposed to all 7 of the heads having the crowns. And this shows the final manifestation and the 10 kings that are going to arise out of the Roman Empire, out of the fourth beast, according to Daniel, in the end times. All right. Then, of course, Daniel goes on to talk about the little horn that comes up among the 10, and that little horn is the Antichrist himself. All right, so he arises, and anyway, we talked about that time before last. Now, one of the things that points that I made last time was that the beast coming up out of the sea is portraying a Gentile kingdom, not a Jewish kingdom. And the little horn must be a Gentile king. It cannot be a Jewish king. And that is because the sea, the Mediterranean Sea, represents the Gentile powers. And that's proven by the way that Daniel's beasts all come up out of the Mediterranean Sea. And they are all Gentile powers. Okay, so that part is clear. Also, we saw that there were some characteristics of the different Gentile kingdoms on this last beast, like the feet of the feet of a bear, I think it said, and so forth. All right, so We also saw that the beast in verses 1 through 8, the first beast arising, has all the power and the authority of Satan himself. That is, Satan has given this final kingdom and its king, that is the little horn of Daniel 7, his own authority and his own power. Also, his rise to power, or this beast coming up out of the sea, is occurring at what we refer to as the midpoint of Daniel's 70th week, or the middle of that seven-year tribulation period. And this is at the close, or at the end of the 1260-day prophesying of the two witnesses. All right, it coincides, the beast arising coincides with the killing of the two prophets of God. And that's actually stated explicitly. Now, one thing you need to understand is that Revelation 13 is doing, remember, this is all part of that sort of interlude or parenthetical portion of Revelation that includes chapters 11, 12, 13, chapters 12, 13, and 14, which interrupt the flow of the sequential flow of Revelation. And they're there, those three chapters are there to give more explanatory material, that is to give us clarity about certain issues that were brought up previously, all right, to expand upon certain points in the sequence of events that are taking place. And Revelation 13 is a really important part of that, because there was something was introduced in chapters 11 and 12. And in chapter 11, it talks about the two witnesses prophesying, and it refers briefly to a period of time that is going to occur after the two witnesses prophesy. And we see that in a couple of passages. All right, so it's in Revelation chapter 11, verse 2, where it says, they will also trample the holy city 42 months. Now, those 42 months where the holy city is going to be trampled is referring to after the period of time of the two witnesses. Now, how do we know that? Well, first of all, it's because in Luke 21, Jesus said that that Jerusalem was going to be trampled down by the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles are fulfilled. And that was beginning in AD 70, that's when Jerusalem was trampled by the Gentiles, until the time of the Gentiles were fulfilled. Well, when is the time of the Gentiles fulfilled? That was the beginning of this 70th week, the beginning of the time of tribulation, because that's God has destroyed, he sent the Romans to destroy the temple and Jerusalem so that the worship of God at the temple and according to the law of Moses, the covenant God made with Moses, was impossible to keep during that time of exile. This is the second exile of Israel from the land. And so the parameters of that period of time are when the temple is out of commission. All right? And it was the same way when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the temple. The temple was desolate for 70 years, and that is the parameters, that 70-year period is the parameters of that first exile of Israel from the land, all right? When the land was resting according to God's commandment. So, Israel is driven out of the land again in AD 70. That begins this time of the trampling of Jerusalem underfoot by the Gentiles. And then that period ends with the beginning of the 70th week, because that's when the two witnesses then begin to prophesy. The temple is rebuilt. We see in chapter 11 of Revelation that there are people worshiping at the altar, which is part of the temple, which indicates that the Mosaic covenant is in place again. And because you cannot have an altar, you cannot worship according to at the altar, which is according to the Mosaic covenant, unless the covenant is in place. Well, that's because in Daniel 9 it says that in the midst, or that God is going to confirm or strengthen the covenant for 1 week. That is for the 7 year period, which gives the Jews then the opportunity to come back and begin to repent according to the conditions established in the law of Moses. All right. So anyway, the two witnesses prophesy for 1260 days, and during their prophesying, the Jews, or some of the Jews, that is a remnant of the Jews, a faithful remnant, 12,000 from each tribe, they are returning to God's law, and they are worshiping at the temple according to God's instructions and according to the fact that the two prophets have now reinstated the worship of God at the temple. Now, when the prophets are killed, it says in chapter 11 that the beast arising out of the abyss, and the abyss, by the way, is the depths of the ocean in the Old Testament. Everywhere you see that word used in the Septuagint, it's talking about the depths of the ocean. And so it says the beast arising from the abyss will kill them. And then it's because of the beast, or as he arises from the abyss, which is what John then sees in Revelation 13, that the period of time of their testimony against Israel ends, and they have a new role after that, which we talked about back in when we were going through chapter 12. All right, so we see this second period of time where then he goes on to say they will also trample the holy city 42 months in Revelation 11:2, meaning that there is another trampling of the holy city of Jerusalem for the final 3.5 years after this sort of hiatus in the trampling of Jerusalem, right? It began in AD 70. It ends in when the two prophets show up on the scene at the beginning of the 70th week. It is not the holy city, or the temple is not, the temple of God is not trampled by the Gentiles for 1260 days while the prophets are prophesying. But then he goes on to say, but it will be trampled again for 42 months. Again, that's referring to the second half. So we see the second half predicted when it's talking about the first half. Well, then it also goes on in chapter Revelation 12, verse 12. It says that the devil has come down to you having great anger, having known that he has a brief time. Now, the brief time there is the 42 months that follow the prophesying of the two witnesses when this beast is going to arise out of the sea and he's going to do all of those things. So it's again, Revelation 13 is filling us in on that period of time. Then also in Revelation 12, verse 4, it talks about the woman fleeing to the wilderness, and it says, two wings of a great eagle were given to the woman so that she might fly to the wilderness, to her place where she is nourished there. And then it quotes Daniel, a time, times, and half a time from before the snake. So this second period of 3.5 years is for the beast to trample the holy city 42 months. It's for Satan to release his anger for a brief time. And it is for the woman to be preserved in the wilderness for, again, a time, times, half a time. But that's borrowed out of Daniel chapter 12 when it's referring to the time after the midpoint of the tribulation. All right, so again, what chapter 13 does is it defines that second 3.5 years and what's going to take place during that second 3.5 years. It defines that for us because those time periods had been mentioned previously. All right. Now, let's look at Revelation chapter 13 again, and we're going to look at the last part of the chapter, beginning in verse 11. All right. Now, remember in chapter 11, verse 7, this is key to understanding the sequence of events in Revelation, right? In chapter 11, verse 7, when it's talking about the two witnesses, it says this, when they should finish their witness, the beast, and remember, this beast hasn't been introduced yet, which is why chapter 13 then has to go and talk about him. But it says, when they should finish their witness, the beast ascending out of the deep, that is coming up out of the sea, just as John saw him, we'll do battle with them, we'll conquer them, and we'll kill them. And also in that chapter, it talks about the reaction of the people. Because remember, when the two witnesses were prophesying, it says that if anyone tries to kill them, that fire proceeds out of their mouth and destroys their enemies. And so they are, these two prophets, they're prophesying in Jerusalem, they are holding the enemies of God at bay while the temple is reconstructed, or perhaps it's reconstructed prior to that, but at least while the worship of the 144,000 is taking place in the temple, you know, all the Muslim nations would like to go in and just blow that to smithereens, because they're, you know, they think that the Temple Mount and all that stuff is, you know, is holy to Islam, and here are the Jews now worshiping and having animal sacrifices and having a priesthood. You can imagine the kind of fury that's going to take place in the Islamic world because of that. And these two prophets are going to be protecting that ongoing worship in Jerusalem while they prophesy, and while the fire, it says, you know, fire comes out of their mouth and destroys their enemies. But obviously fire isn't literally coming out of their mouth. It's simply saying they speak the word and their enemies are destroyed, just like Elijah did, right? Fire came down from heaven when Elijah made certain statements, right? All right, so now we have the timing down right, because the beast ascends from the abyss, or the deep, at the midpoint of the tribulation. And we know that because he's allowed to continue 42 months, which is the last part of the tribulation. And this is when he ascends out of the abyss or the deep, he kills the two prophets. So therefore, the two prophets have to prophesy prior to the 42 months, the second 42 months. Okay, so all of that, all that language lines up the chronology of events for us within that overall 7-year period. All right, now let's begin reading in the Revelation chapter 13, beginning in verse 11. There's a second beast now that's introduced after the first beast who comes up out of the deep or the sea. Verse 11, it says, "And I observed another beast rising out of the land, and it had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. And it exercises all the authority of the first beast before it. And it compels the land and those dwelling in it so that they will worship the first beast whose blow of death was healed. And it does great signs so that it may also make fire come down from the sky onto the land before men. And it deceives those who dwell in the land by the signs which were given to it to do before the first beast, saying to those dwelling on the land to make an image to the beast which had the blow of the sword and lives." That is the resurrected beast. That is that one head that it talked about previously in this chapter, who had the wound of the sword, but yet lived, right? It had a deadly wound, and the deadly wound was healed. Well, that's talking about one of the previous seven kings that was empowered by Satan himself, and one of Satan's prior kingdoms. That one of those seven kings is coming back. And he is going to be resurrected, and he is going to be the Antichrist, all right? Now, and that's represented by one of the heads being wounded to death and comes to life. But now this second beast comes up, and it's telling others to worship the first beast. Let's continue reading. Verse 15, "And it was granted to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast may speak and may require as many as should not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And it requires all, small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, that they should receive a mark on their right hand or on their forehead, and that no one may buy or sell without having the mark, the name of the beast, or the number of its name. Here is wisdom. Let him that has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. His number is 666. Now, there's a lot to unpack in this section. All right, but let's go back to verse 11. It says, "I observed another beast rising out of the land." Now, it was important that we understood that the beast arising from the sea was a Gentile king and the arising of his Gentile dominion, his power. Okay, and that was one of the seven heads. However, this beast is not arising from the sea or the abyss. This beast is arising from the land. Now, it's not just the ground as compared to the sea. It's the land of Israel. You see, the Mediterranean Sea, the coastline of the Mediterranean Sea goes around to many Gentile nations, but it also is the coast of the land of Israel. And all of this, the central focus of the book of Revelation is the land of Israel. All right? And that's true of all prophecy. Really, if you look at Daniel's prophecies in Daniel 7, 8, 11, 12, it's all focused on the land of Israel, that is God's land or the Holy Land. And so it says, this beast is arising out of the land. Well, what does that mean for us? Well, what it means is he's arising out of the promised land. He's arising out of the land of Israel. The second beast is an Israelite. All right? An Israelite. Probably, and almost certainly, he's of the tribe of Levi, that is the priestly line. Because, as we'll see, the things that he's doing concern the temple in Jerusalem, and he will be the one to instigate the abomination of desolation in the temple, as we'll see in a moment. All right, so the second beast, while the first beast concerns the whole of the Roman Empire, the old Roman Empire, and the original dominion of that little horn, when he was in power previously before he received the deadly wound, that would encompass Europe, it would encompass Syria, it would include Iran and Iraq, it would even include Egypt, that whole area that has been battled over, really, by all of those previous kingdoms, but to its largest extent would have been the Roman Empire, because the Roman Empire captured much more land even to the west, all the way to Great Britain. All right, so that's the beast that arises out of the sea. His dominion stretches over from Britain in the west all the way through, Iran in the east, and then probably from the area of the Black Sea north of Turkey down all the way down through North Africa, including Egypt, Libya, and that area. Okay, so that's a very large area, but it's not the whole planet Earth. All right, when it talks about the land here, it's talking about the land that, when it's related to those kings, it's talking about the land that was under the dominion of those kings previously. All right. Anyway, let's see, where am I? We read verse 11. It says, I observed another beast arising out of the land, that is out of the land of Israel. And it had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. Well, what in the world does that mean? Well, first of all, a lamb and a dragon are like opposites. Lambs are very mild and timid and meek, but dragons, obviously, are the exact opposite. Satan is referred to as the dragon. And it says, the next verse says, it exercises all the authority of the first beast before it. Well, what authority did the first beast have before it? It says specifically that Satan gave the first beast its power and its authority, or his authority, his power and authority. So what that is saying, what that is telling us is that it is like the first beast, which is ultimately the Antichrist, who has Satan's power and authority and exercises a Gentile dominion that's widespread. The second beast is out of the land of Israel. And what it's telling us is it's going to appear to be as a lamb, mild, meek, religious, righteous, whatever. But it's going to speak like a dragon, and that is because, verse 12 tells us why, because the authority that it has is coming from Satan, the same one that has given authority to the first beast. Okay. All right. Then it says, verse 13. Just a second here. Just one second. All right. Something I want to point out, I was thinking about saving this for later, but I'll go ahead and get into it now. It says it exercises all the authority of the first beast, and it compels the land and those dwelling in it so that they will worship the first beast whose blow of death was healed. Now, the first beast, the Antichrist, is a king who has come before, and he was destroyed by God. But he's going to be resurrected in the end times, and that king. If you've gone through my lessons on Daniel, you know that that beast, that person, is Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes. In fact, all this that's going to take place in these verses, beginning in verse 11, all the way through the end of this chapter, are parallel to what Antiochus Epiphanes did in all the way back roughly 150 years before Christ. All right, it's all about the story of Hanukkah too. The story of Hanukkah is all about this. Well, you need to know a little bit of the history, I guess, of what Antiochus Epiphanes did in order to see the exact parallel that's taking place here in the last half of Revelation chapter 13. All right, now what did Antiochus Epiphanes do? Just one second here. All right, first of all, the first thing he did, when Antiochus came down from Syria, he was a Syrian king. When he came down from Syria, what he wanted to do was he wanted to exercise his dominion over the land of Israel. And so, seeing that the land of Israel worshiped the God of Abraham, and they worshiped at the temple, and the priesthood was in charge of the temple, the first thing he did was he got rid of the high priest. The high priest was Onias. And Onias was a faithful high priest, and he was doing his best to follow the law of Moses, along with all the priests that were under his supervision. Well, what Antiochus did is he had him removed from being the high priest, and his younger brother was ambitious, and his younger brother wanted to be the high priest. And so Antiochus used the fact that he was ambitious, and he installed the younger brother to be the high priest, because the younger brother, his name was Yeshua, by the way, the same name as Jesus. Yeshua was, he agreed, and you know, because Antiochus was giving him the role of high priest, he agreed to, basically paganize the priesthood, to Hellenize the priesthood, to allow the pagan rituals that Antiochus wanted to bring into Jerusalem and in Judea in order to get the Jews to be loyal to him and his god, his pagan god Zeus. He replaced the Jewish high priest with his younger brother Yeshua, and Yeshua then immediately changed his name to a Greek name to show his loyalty to Antiochus, and his Greek name was Jason. So Jason then Hellenized the whole priesthood to make them adopt the customs of the Greeks as opposed to the customs that God had required as part of the Mosaic law. And so then also Jason, the high priest now, the new high priest, he welcomes Antiochus into the city of Jerusalem with all this great pomp and all this stuff, you know, that he is now our king. Antiochus Epiphanes, the king of Israel, really is what he was doing. And it was because then the priests who were sort of loyal to God, who were then on the outs at the temple, they began to try to rebel against Antiochus. And then it was that rebellion that led to Antiochus then bringing, or having his generals bring an idol, the idol of Zeus, into the temple of God, and defile the temple of God by placing the idol of Zeus in the temple. And that's what happened. And then there was a three-year war after that, where the priesthood that was loyal to God sort of had to, you know, scramble and hid in the mountains, and they had a sort of a guerrilla war against Antiochus and his forces and the priests at the temple and the Jews who were submitting to Antiochus. And this went on for 3 years, right? And then the story of Hanukkah is all about the defeat of Antiochus and the cleansing of the temple. Anyway, all that stuff took place, but it was because that Antiochus replaced the priest at the temple, the high priest at the temple, with his own, somebody who was loyal to him, but who was a Jew and who was of the tribe of Levi and who was, and who could have been high priest, you know, but he, because of his loyalty to Antiochus, he was placed, Jason was placed as the high priest. All right. Now, what we see happening here with this false prophet arising out of the land is parallel to what Antiochus did. What we have now is a priest who is going to be made high priest. Now, you may remember we talked earlier that the priesthood had been reinstated under God's two prophets, right? Under John and Elijah in the previous 1260-day period. But now the first beast coming up out of the deep, he kills the two witnesses. Then he's seen as liberating the people from the plagues that the two prophets were calling down from God. And remember, they were sending gifts to one another and all those things previously. So now we have they are killed. So the former priesthood now is now gone, and it's replaced with a priesthood that's installed by the first beast. And so the second beast that arises out of the land is parallel exactly to what happened under Antiochus Epiphanes. That is, Jason, who was given the priesthood after the rightful priest was taken out of the way, he then is encouraging, Jason encouraged the Jews to abandon the Sabbath, to abandon God's laws, to adopt the Greek customs, to accept Antiochus Epiphanes as their king. And again, he wasn't just the king of Israel. He had a much larger kingdom. It's just that Israel was refusing to submit to him as king of this large empire. And so he used Jason, appointing him high priest, to get the nation of Israel to subdue and to be under his authority also, like these other Gentile nations from the larger empire. Okay, so that is the model for what's taking place in the end times, and that helps us identify who this beast is out of the land. This second beast, the one out of the land, is the false prophet. He's referred to, by the way, as the false prophet three times later in the book of Revelation. Now, why would he be called a false prophet? Well, because he is following after the true prophets of God, the two prophets that were in chapter 11, but this one is being appointed by the Antichrist himself to subdue and to keep the Jews under his dominion, under his larger dominion of the entire empire. All right. So let's see, where am I here in my notes? All right, let's look at verse 13. It says that he does great signs. Actually, you know what? I skipped something that I should have gone over. We talked about the second beast causes the abomination. No, you know what? I'll wait till later. Sorry about that. I can put it in later. All right. Anyway, Go to verse 13. It says, "And it does great signs, so that it may also make fire come down from the sky." That is the second beast, who is the false prophet, who is the high priest now of the temple of God that is being defiled by the first beast, which we'll see in a moment. "He does great signs so that it may also make fire come down from the sky onto the land before men." Now, who was it in the Old Testament that caused fire to come down from the sky? We saw that previously in chapter 11, the two prophets are going to call fire down from the sky, and they're going to call down plagues also. But who was it in the Old Testament that called down fire from the sky? Well, this is an important part of understanding what's going on here. So let's go to 1 Kings chapter 18. You may remember that in Israel, in Elijah's day, there were many of the nation of Israel were worshiping Baal, the pagan god, Baal. And Elijah the prophet, this came to a head when Elijah the prophet had a showdown with the prophets of Baal. Remember that? And verse 30, it says, "Then Elijah said to all the people, 'Come near me.' So all the people came near him, and he prepared the altar of the Lord that was broken down." And you may remember that the prophets of Baal, there's a contest, right, between Elijah and the prophets of Baal. They both built an altar, and they both put their animal sacrifices on it. One is an altar to Baal, one is an altar to the God of Abraham. And they said, they agreed that whoever's God would answer by fire and consume the offering on the altar that was built for him, that would be the true God, right? So after the prophets of Baal, they build their altar, they put their sacrifice there, and then they're calling out to Baal to answer with fire. Nothing happens. And you know the story, Elijah's mocking them. You know, maybe your God's asleep, maybe he's on vacation, maybe with this, maybe that. But the point was that Baal was not the true God. So then in verse 30, it says, "Then Elijah said to all the people, 'Come near to me.' So all the people came near to him, and he prepared the altar of the Lord that was broken down. And Elijah took 12 stones, according to the number of the 12 tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, 'Israel shall be your name.' Then with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he made a trench around the altar large enough to hold 2 seahs of seed. And he put the wood in order, cut in pieces, the bull in pieces, and laid it on the wood, and said, 'Fill 4 water pots with water and pour it on the burnt sacrifice and on the wood.' And he said, 'Do it a second time.' And they did it a second time. He said, 'Do it a third time.' They did it a third time. So water ran all around the altar, and he filled the trench with water. And it came to pass at the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice that Elijah the prophet came near and said, 'Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and I am your servant, that I have done all these things at your word. Hear me, O Lord, hear me, that this people may know that you are the Lord God, and that you have turned their hearts back to you again.' Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice and the wood and the stones and the dust, and licked up the water that was in the trench. Now when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces, and they said, 'The Lord, he is God, the Lord, he is God.'" And then what happened? Then Elijah had the prophets of Baal seized, and they were all executed. Now, this is a showdown between two sets of prophets. You've got the prophets of Baal, and you've got Elijah. And it was to prove who was the true God. Well, see, Satan's never gotten over that. He got defeated badly by Elijah. Well, in the end times, the Antichrist is going to claim to be God, and he's a Gentile. He's going to claim to be God, and he's going to take his place in the temple of God and claim to be God. That is the supreme ruler over the entire earth. And this false prophet is going to do exactly what Antiochus Epiphanes did, because did you know that Antiochus Epiphanes, his name was Antiochus, but he called himself Epiphanes, and Epiphanes was a term that meant God manifest, that is, manifested God, That is the God who has been shown to you, been revealed to you. Right? That's what he called himself. Well, I want you to look in your Bibles at 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 for just a moment. Paul talks about this. Excuse me. He says, beginning in verse 1, he says, "Now, brethren, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our gathering together to him, we ask you not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled, neither by spirit or by word or letter, as from us, as though the day of Christ had come," or literally had become imminent. "Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first and the man of sin is revealed." That's the first beast. The son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. "Do you not remember that when I was with you, I told you these things? And now you know that what is restraining, that he may be revealed in his time. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who is now restrains will do so until he's taken out of the way." The restrainer there, by the way, is Michael and his angels. We saw that taking place at the midpoint when Satan is cast down to the earth to basically have free reign on the earth. That was in Revelation chapter 12. We saw that taking place, the seven-headed dragon, right? "And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming." Now notice this in verse 9. "The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan." Isn't that what it says here? He exercises the same power as the first beast, who had his power and authority from Satan. So it says, according to the working of Satan, "with all power, signs, and lying wonders." Now the signs, the lying wonders, are what the second beast is going to do, and he is going to cause people then, because of these things, to worship the man of sin, the Antichrist. "And with all of unrighteousness, deceptions among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. For this reason, God will send them the strong delusion that they should believe a lie, that they all may be condemned, who did not believe the truth and had pleasure in unrighteousness." Now, what he's talking about here is the deception of mainly Israel here, because he is the high priest of Israel, but it's the deception of apostate Israel. Now, the deception will probably also, you know, extend to apostate Christianity as well. But here in Revelation chapter 13, the last part of it, he's talking about the deception of apostate Israel, which is the other part of Israel, apart from the 144,000 who were the faithful, who were worshiping at the temple under the leadership of the two prophets in the first half of the 70th week. All right. So then it says, let's go back to Revelation chapter 13. "He calls down fire from heaven." Why is he doing that? Because what he's doing is he's reversing what happened under Elijah. Under Elijah, the false prophets couldn't call down fire from heaven. Now, the beast from the abyss, the first beast, has killed God's true prophets. He's now appointed a new high priest who is going to be loyal to him at the temple of God in Israel. That's this second beast arising out of the land. And now that beast then is going to cause the nation of Israel to worship the first beast, this Gentile king, that is to worship Antiochus Epiphanes. And it's a replay of what happened all the way back in the days of Antiochus Epiphanes before he received the deadly wound. All right, so let's go to verse 13. I'm sorry, we did verse 13 also. Verse 14, it says, "And it that is the second beast, that is the false prophet, deceives those who dwell on the land by the signs which were given it to do before the beast, saying to all those dwelling on the land to make an image to the beast which had the blow of the sword and lives." So this beast, the second beast, is loyal to the first beast. It's telling the people of the land, notice that, the people of the land, that is the people of the land of Israel, that is the Jewish nation, the Israeli nation. He's telling them that they need to make an image to the first beast, that is the Antichrist, who has an empire, you know, a large empire. They're to make an image for the beast, or possibly of the beast, but it literally says to the beast, which has the blow of the sword and lives. Again, Antiochus Epiphanes, resurrected from the dead, is the Antichrist. All right. So they make this image, and this is, by the way, this image is the abomination of desolation. All right. You remember that I told you, and this is what Antiochus did. With the cooperation of the apostate priesthood at the temple under Jason, and his apostasy there, right? Because that a good portion of the priesthood was apostate, and a good portion of Israel was apostate and was willing to have Antiochus as their leader. And because of all of this, the apostasy that was going on, but there was still the rebellion of the faithful, Antiochus had this image placed in the temple of God. Now, I want you to go to Mark chapter 13, for just a moment. And I know I'm going a little long today, but I need to finish this chapter. So, Mark chapter 13. And let's look at verse 14. So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. Now, if you were to go back to Daniel chapter 11 and chapter 12. In chapter 11, it talks about Antiochus Epiphanes committing the abomination of desolation. The abomination of desolation that Antiochus did was putting the image, or having the image of Zeus installed in the altar, right? And again, Antiochus claimed to be God manifest, that is the manifestation of Zeus. Well, Paul said that the Antichrist is going to go into the temple of God and show himself that he is God. Now, it's the temple in Jerusalem. That's the temple of God. And he's going to claim to be God. But the abomination of desolation is the image that's described in Revelation 13, where the new high priest of the temple of God, who's loyal to the Antichrist, is going to have the image of the beast installed in the temple in Jerusalem to be worshipped. All right, and it's a representation of the first beast, the Antichrist, because he won't be living in Jerusalem at this time. He's going to have his empire spread out in a large area, right? So anyway, it says, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, and again, that has already happened, but if he says when you see it, he's talking about the future, so it means it's going to happen twice. The abomination of desolation happens twice. It already happened with Antiochus Epiphanes, but it says when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing where it ought not. And I want you to underline the word it. All right, it uses a neuter term here. It doesn't use the, it's not talking about the Antichrist himself standing where he ought not, although he will be present for the dedication of his image at the temple in Jerusalem, which is what Paul describes, him taking his seat in the temple of God. The abomination of desolation is an it, it's not a him. And the abomination of desolation is the image of the beast being installed in the temple of God by the second beast, who is the new high priest in God's temple, who's loyal to the Antichrist and not loyal to God. Then it says, notice this again. Let me read again in Mark 13, 14. So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing where it ought not, let the reader understand. Now, what does that mean, let the reader understand? It means let the reader of Daniel understand. Let the reader of Daniel understand that the abomination of desolation that Antiochus committed so long ago, about 150 years before Christ, is going to happen again in the last days. All right. And then it says, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. let him who is on the housetop not go down into the house, nor enter or take anything from his house. And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. And woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies in those days. And pray that your flight may not be the winter. What in winter? What flight is that? It's the flight to the wilderness of the woman going to the place of safety. All right? We talked about that back in chapter 12. All right, so I wanted to point out the fact that the abomination of desolation is described in Revelation right here. It's not called the abomination of desolation here, but it's described here. Look what it says. Go back to verse 13. It says, it does great signs so that it may also make fire come down from the sky onto the land before men. It deceives those who dwell in the land, that is the land of Israel, by the signs which were given it to do before the beast, saying to those dwelling on the land to make an image to the beast, which has the blow of the sword and lives. And it was granted to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast may speak and may require as many as should not worship the image of the beast should be killed. Now this is really, really fascinating. Not only does the false prophet make fire come down from heaven in order to do what the prophets of Baal couldn't do, and he's doing this by the authority granted to him, but now it says he also, it says it was granted to give breath to the image of the beast. That is, the second beast, the false prophet, is granted the power and authority, I should say, to give breath to the image of the beast. So this image appears to come to life, and it begins to speak, and it probably actually moves and has facial expressions and begins to give orders. And you may notice that in verse 15, it's the image of the beast that has come to life that is actually giving orders from Satan. By the way, this is the satanic trinity here. And to it was granted to give breath to the image of the beast so that the image of the beast may speak and, that is the image, may require as many as should not worship the image of the beast should be killed. So the image is stating that those who would not worship it as the image of the Antichrist must be killed. Verse 16, and it requires all, small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, that they should receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell without having the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of its name. Now, you know what's critical about this is, which beast is it talking about? Is it talking about the second beast or the first beast? I think he's talking about the second beast. In my opinion, he identifies in this, at the beginning of verse 11 through the end of the chapter, whenever it's talking about the second beast, it just uses the word beast. But when it's talking about the first beast, it talks about the beast who was wounded by the sword but lived, right? So here he's talking, this image is requiring all, small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, that they must receive this mark on their forehand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell without the mark, the name of the beast. What beast? The second beast. That is the name of the false prophet. I'm pretty sure that's what this is saying, all right? Or the number of its name, that is the name of the beast, the false prophet. And then verse 18 says, here is wisdom. Let him that has understanding calculate the number of the beast, and that's the number of the false prophet beast. For it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Now, you know, people have struggled with how to interpret verse 18 for a long time. There's so many different opinions on this. But most say that what this is saying is that, you know, first of all, I think their first mistake is they think it's talking about the Antichrist himself. And it's not. It's talking about the false prophet. It's talking about the second beast, the one that comes up out of the land of Israel. He's the one who has the number of his name being 666. There's most people, when they read this, they say, well, what that means is that in Greek, you know, the letters have numerical value. And so 666, anybody's name, you can calculate the number of anybody's name by looking at the value of the Greek letters in their name. And that may be, I'm saying that's a possibility, and that's been the common interpretation of this. But notice it says it is the number of a man. That is, there's a man with this number. And in Ezra, let's just look at this real quick and then I'll be done. In Ezra chapter 2, verse 13, there's a man who has this number associated with his name. It just seems odd to me, okay? And again, I'm giving my opinion now on how we should interpret this number, whether we should use, you know, this practice that was common among the pagans of using numerical values to, you know, decipher the meaning, you know, of people's names, things like that, or whether it's something that is much more in line with the Bible, I would say, and that is what we see here in Ezra 2:13. Let's just look at that real quick. Ezra 2, verse 13. It says the people of Adonikam, 666. That is, there were, when Ezra returned to rebuild the temple, there he had family members with him. 666. So the number associated with Adonikam is 666. Interesting. We don't see that number showing up in the Bible associated with a man, except here. 666 associated with the man called Adonikam. Well, what's fascinating about the name Adonikam is in Hebrew, it has a meaning. Because almost all Hebrew names have a very important meaning. Well, what does the name Adonikam mean in Hebrew? It means, get this, my master has arisen. My master has arisen. Now, if the false prophet's name is Adonikam, and it's identified in the Bible by the number 666 here in Ezra chapter 2, and he is installed as high priest because he's going to be loyal to the Antichrist, who has an empire, a Gentile empire, but he is going to cause the apostate Israel to worship the new emperor, the Antichrist, as opposed to worshiping God. And he's going to convert the temple of God into the temple of the Antichrist, who goes into the temple of God and says, I am now God. Right, I'm now the supreme ruler, not the God of heaven. Look, I defeated his prophets, and I seized his temple. Wow, that's pretty impressive. And because Satan is going to be allowed to deceive the whole world, as it says back there in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, he's going to need the help of the newly installed high priest in the temple of God in Jerusalem in order to get apostate Israel to fall in line, just like Antiochus Epiphanes did so long ago, in order to get the apostate priesthood and a large portion of apostate Israel to subject themselves now to the Greek customs, to abandon God and abandon God's law. It's all happening again. It's playing out exactly the same in the end times. There's no doubt in my mind that this is the rerun of what happened with Antiochus Epiphanes, only now it's on a larger scale, and he's going to have success in doing this for 42 months. Anyway, I didn't finish reading. Did I read that? Did I finish reading? I think I did. Yeah, I did. Okay. All right, well, I know that was kind of a complicated lesson, but and I went really, really long, and I'm sorry about that, but I really needed to finish that without interruption, okay? All right, so we'll see you again next time. We'll pick up in chapter 14. God bless you all.